It's another edition of the Talking Mets podcast here on this Sunday, February the 15th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join us at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show, interactions with me, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. Well, we're kicking off spring training here. Full squad reports tomorrow. Pitchers and catchers have reported. We kicked off with a special show on Wednesday, talked about Juan Soto's move to left, Lindor's Hammett surgery, the two top 10 anchors, big stories out of the gate here. At Port St. Lucie, we'll be doing what really is our first official start of the baseball season here. The hot stove is behind us, although weather is warming up here in New York. It's still pretty cold, but we're a week away, less than a week away from actual spring training games, and we can start talking about baseball, put the transaction log away, put the hot stove away, and the journey begins here at the Talking Mets podcast. With our, you know, starting it out, spring training, you know, before we get to our phases of the season here, kind of putting the roster together, kind of learning a little bit about what this team is all about. So big show here today, trying some things different. I'll get into the roster. I'll get into some of the positional battles, some of the players I'm looking to watch here. That'll be the start of it. We are going to address, Jeff Passan came out with an article over at ESPN, some labor strife potentially on the way, some ominous quotes from some owners. I'm bringing in a former county court judge, author, lawyer, Lou Schiff, get his thoughts, you know, talk about a little bit his thoughts on some of the labor strife that's coming up. I think it's a big story. It's a story I think that's coming out now. I think it'll be put in the closet, but will pop up from time to time throughout the season. And I'll give you my thoughts on that. And then as we wrap up and I do the mailbag, I figured let's bring in someone who could be the voice of the fan with me. And John from Mets Metrics over on X decided to be the first guinea pig on this. Pop on and address some of the fans' questions and concerns and thoughts during the mailbag. So try something a little bit different here. So big kickoff show, our spring training kickoff show, and we're in full force here at the Talking Mets podcast. So let's lay it out here. Mets have really no roster spots after the signings of MJ Melendez and the trade of Brian Hudson. They've put McGill and Garrett on the 60-day IL. So really at this point, the Mets roster is set. You know, maybe Daniel Nunez gets put on the 60-day IL to make room. I think that's where the Kimbrel situation comes into play. So let's set the stage there with the roster. Now, I'm not going to start getting into worrying about, and I've seen the emails and we'll address it in the mailbag. I'm not going to worry about veterans like Bichette moving to third base and Polanco at first base yet. Simeon, of course, is coming back from a pretty serious foot injury. Everybody's working their way back into shape. I'm not going to get crazy about the stats. I'm not going to get crazy about the videos. That's what spring training's for. And it's probably a week too long. With the WBC, I don't think the Mets have a tremendous amount of disruption with the WBC. Some, I'm not going to really worry about that. Right now, it's really about playing the shape. I'm not going to get into it with the results and what have you. That's not what I'm going to worry about. The veterans are the least of my concern. I think the big story this spring will be similar to what turned out to be the big story in the spring of 2019 when Pete Alonso took over spring training and ripped the first base job away from Dom Smith and anybody else who was thinking about any other veteran who was in camp at that time, and that's Carson Benj. And I don't think Benj is going to have a spring similar to Alonso in 2019 where he took Port St. Lucie by storm. There was a lot of questions about Alonso, how good he could be, how viable he was as a first baseman and as a big leaguer. And I think Pete and his personality was one that just he always, and you'll probably see this in Baltimore now, he faced adversity, he turned it into his own little agenda to prove everybody wrong. And he wound up throughout his Mets career proving a lot of people wrong, including last year coming back from a so-so season despite his heroic home run in the postseason. Now that Alonso's gone and we could put all that in the closet, Carson Benj is that big positional player that we're all going to be watching. Now, there's been comps that we've given. I've heard Nick Morabito. We talked about that over at the Talking, not Nick Morabito, Nick Markakis. We've talked about that over at the Talking Mets podcast. Joel Sherman recently came out and talked to some scouts who see a little Steve Finley in him. And then there's the top of the top. Some feel he could be like Kyle Tucker, which would be incredibly awesome to see, and that would be an impact bat on the levels of a David Wright and an Alonzo and some of the great hitters that have come through the Mets system, Strawberry and so on and so forth. It's been a while, and Pete was a very good offensive piece that came through the system, but let's be fair, you know, I've had Michael Conforto, David Wright, Reyes. These are impact bats of different levels, very good all-star to potential Hall of Fame type seasons that you've seen. But the Mets haven't had a ton of impact bats come through the roster over the last few years. Now, maybe that's Beatty. Maybe that's Alvarez. Those guys, they're still to be determined. So the Mets could potentially have Benj and those two guys break out at the same time. I think that this is a very big spring for Alvarez, Beatty, and even Vientos, and to a lesser extent, Mauricio. Mauricio will get an opportunity. I have him pegged as the favorite to come out of spring if Lindor cannot be ready for opening day. And quite honestly, he should not rush back, even if it means some extended spring, first 2 weeks of the season. Do not rush back. Let Mauricio handle the position. As long as Mauricio has a consistent role of some sort that has consistent playing time. And the only way I see that happening is if shortstop is not manned by Lindor, or the DH spot, which right now is not something that's an option. Mauricio should then be down at AAA. But if you want to start the season in New York, get him some reps, maybe even start a controversy if he plays well on both sides of the ball, give him that spot to come out of spring. He's the guy out of all the names that are going to be mentioned for Lindor replacements that got to hit the best. His fielding was sneaky elite. Nobody really talked about a third base. I'm sure he'll be able to handle the position at short well enough. So I think that this is a big spring for Mauricio, and he'll be actually a topic of conversation because the Mets kept him on the bench and stunted his development after the injury that kept him out a year, whatnot, basically for a procedural reason because of options. So now they have that, and either Mauricio is going to find his way and push his way into the roster in some way, shape, or form, or be a big piece if he has a big season in Syracuse of for some sort of trade at some point. So I'd like to see some of the kids. Nate Lavender is back. Ryan Lambert out of the bullpen. Jack Weniger. Jonah Tong. Jonathan Santucci. There's going to be some interesting names. You know, Weniger is a name that he will not make the club. Christian Scott will not make the club. But these are young arms that I think are going to be the next man up and can make for some very interesting, controversial pitching decisions later in the year. It looks like the Mets might be going with a six-man rotation. That remains to be seen. So those are some of the names that we're looking to add. But you know, just to start from the offensive side, the starting nine is set, and you have Torrens, Taylor, and Vientos on your bench, assuming no injuries. Beatty and Alvarez have options. They aren't going anywhere. The only way I could see Beatty not making the club is maybe if they want to put him down in extended spring or some work in the outfield, if they're really serious about this right field thing. Mauricio's options, and I do not think he makes the club if he's not. If Lindor makes the club and is ready to go day one of spring training, Mauricio's not going to make the club as a utility guy off the bench. They're not going to do that to them. He has to have a consistent role. So at that point, I think on the positional side, you have to, and I know that this is something that probably will bother some people. I think you have to take the utility position, the Cloughs, the Kessigers, the Christian Arroyos seriously. And I know the Mets have never really, I mean, McNeil was your utility around the horn guy. Beatty's taking that position at this point, but he's not a shortstop. Neither was McNeil. The Mets, yeah, they had Iglesias do the shortstop position a couple of years ago. Polanco could play shortstop. This is a guy, Lindor, we talked about this a couple of days ago. He's played 160 games. He fracture his toe and he missed a day a few years ago. He's never taken any time off. The Mets don't really worry about even giving him innings off in blowouts. He's out there all the time. Got to give him a ton of credit on that. Has that contributed to some of his Hammond injury? I don't think so. But as you enter he's smack in the middle of his prime, heading towards his late prime, playing a demanding position. I think you want to maximize whatever elite seasons you have left. Remember, we talked about this. As you enter age 31, 32, you're kind of at that demarcation line where even Hall of Fame shortstops started to see the Jeters, the Larkins, the Trammels, even very good shortstops like Miguel Tejada started to begin the ascent to decline. And, you know, you either move off the position, you know, Robin Yount moved to center field later in his career, an even more premium position, or you, you know, somehow have a modified workload, maybe more time off and things like that. I don't know if Lindor is at that point. I'm not sure if the Mets even feel he's at that point. But if he is, you're going to need a viable shortstop, not somebody like a Bo Bichette moving over for a day or a Polanco. I mean, I guess you could do that based on pitching matchup, you know, the amount of ground balls you anticipate to the left side of the infield. But I think with both Polanco and Bichette, you want them to be home at their new positions and being there consistently, honing that position, and not pulling them off. So I think that the Cloughs, the Kessingers, and the Brujans have a very good shot at making this club. I mean, remember, Nick Madrigal, before he got hurt, was going to potentially be a utility option that they were thinking about. Brujan is on the 40-man, so he has a leg up. But, you know, Kessinger has the Troy Snitker effect. I've talked about that. Arroyo has some big league experience off the bench. He doesn't have a bad bat. He did it in Boston for a while, though shortstop is not his primary position. Clough is a guy who's never got a shot at the big leagues. He's a glove guy. So, you know, you look at that, and then it puts MJ Melendez and Jared Young, also some interesting bats for the final spot. You know, Melendez, talked about in the New York Post earlier this week, as could play center field now. He could be an emergency catcher. There's a lot of value in that. Lefty bat, power bat, somebody that is, you know, the problem is you really needed a righty bat to spell maybe Benj against a tough lefty. And I guess that could be Tyrone Taylor, who's really a fourth outfielder. I wouldn't put him as a viable bat that when you put him in and he plays right field. I mean, him and Robert Jr. both, you know, have a dynamic outfield. It's like a vacuum cleaners out there with the two of them out there. But I don't think that that's something that you want to do consistently. But, you know, right now you have Jared Young, also lefty bat, a guy with some power. Played a little bit last year, showed a little bit of that power. MJ Melendez, top prospect, speed in Kansas City. So those two guys, I think it's going to come down to, do the Mets need the utility guy? Probably a guy that plays in multiple positions, has a light bat, and is there as insurance in the case that Lindor needs a day off or needs the DH. Or do they go with the offense? Do they go with the power bat off the bench, the pinch hitter, the lefty, and a Young or Melendez? So that'll be a very interesting conversation. And then there's also Nick Morabito and his speed, and he's probably ticketed to AAA, and he had a big Arizona Fall League. And I think long-term he's a fourth outfielder, and maybe he's more a cost-controlled option for Taylor in the long run. But I'll be watching him. I don't think he has a real shot at making the club. But as a righty batter, in a lot of ways, has a better fit there. I mean, really, when you look at the bench, when you have a bench of the backup catcher, Torrens, Taylor is the backup outfielder, and Vientos, which is basically a corner guy in DH, there is a need for a middle infield utility guy on this roster. And Melendez and Jared Young are now that. So I have a feeling that that's where the Mets will go. Even if Lindor makes the team, maybe they'll do it early on to see how he holds up. So that will be something really interesting. And then, you know, look, this is really the spring of Benj. I don't know if there'll be other offensive players throwing themselves in the mix. I know that some of the non-roster invitees are some of the kids here, and I think that they'll get some exposure. And I think the thing about the non-roster invitees, they tell you kind of some of the next man up in case of injuries. You have your Ryan Clifford's a young player that eventually might be able to take over at first base. You have Jacob Reimer, Jose Rojas, potentially somebody that could impress. And then, you know, you have your A.J. Ewings and what have you. So even those kids will get some spots, but they don't have a serious shot at making the roster. They're just, you know, getting that exposure because obviously the Mets feel that they're the next man up. And there's a ton of other, you know, treasure, value arms that are making non-roster invitee appearances. I'm not going to get too crazy into those guys until, you know, obviously there's a reason to take them seriously. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, the pitchers. What do I think about the pitching? What do I think about the bullpen? We'll talk about that right after this. All right, we're back. So the pitching. The pitching was a big conversation last year. We know what happened after about, you know, mid-June with the starters, the three-inning little league starts and what have you, and the Mets are back at it. And look, if you look at this staff, it's much improved. We know the situation with Freddie Peralta anchoring the staff. Nolan McClain, is he the breakout guy? Is he the guy that's going to be the next top 10 young pitcher in baseball? Now that he's coming in, I mean, he didn't go around the league once, but now that there's a book out on him, how does he handle his sophomore year? Even though he's technically a rookie, it's still his sophomore year. How does he handle that? You have to think he's a lock for the rotation unless he shows something here in spring training that gives the Mets a feeling that he needs some more time in the minors. I doubt that. Then you have the veterans like Manaea and Peterson and Senga and Holmes. And to me, Holmes, and I know there's been some debate about this on social media and even those who contact me on X, I think this is kind of an interesting year for Holmes because he's a guy that some have compared to Logan Webb in San Francisco, and a guy who could get, you know, bowling ball, elite ground ball type of guy. Can he be a guy like Manaea a couple of years ago that jumps into the top of the rotation conversation status? Big start in Miami down the stretch, showed you what maybe he can be. I know that's a weak hitting team, but still big performance in a big spot in a big game. So Holmes is definitely somebody I'm looking at. And I think a six-man rotation, the part about the six-man rotation that I don't have the answer for right now, and I don't think the Mets have really committed to it, is how does it impact the veterans like Peralta? How does it impact Peterson and Holmes and Manaea? Senga, you know, is going to be positive on it. McClain is probably going to need some component of it to manage his innings and make him fresh for hopefully a postseason run. Is there a way they could space it out where certain pitchers get more rest and the Peraltas and the Petersons and the Holmes stay on schedule? Maybe Manaea needs a little bit more rest after only pitching, 75 innings last year or so. That's conversations that have not happened yet. It's something to look for. Can one of these guys, can they do a situation where even though it's a six-man rotation, maybe one of them swings into the bullpen in between that gap of a day or two when it's their throw day? We'll see how that plays out. But I think they're going to go with a six-man rotation. Until I hear otherwise, there's no options on this starting rotation other than McClain. I wouldn't just start trading a David Peterson or a Senga. That would have happened already just because you need room. Remember, injuries could absolutely crop up. And those six starters and those kids like Scott and Tong and Winiger and any other, like, you know, Hageman and some of these other depth arms, they could go away real quick in the matter of a couple of days in spring training. So just keep that in mind. So I think they're going to go to six-man rotation, which means they're only going to have a seven-man bullpen. Now, they already have Williams, Weaver, Rayleigh, and Luis Garcia locked up in that bullpen. They already have those four spots. Normally, I would say they'd have five spots because that would add A.J. Minter into the mix. A.J. Minter is going to be out till May. Now, Brian Hudson, an interesting arm, big year in Milwaukee in 24, a guy that they just got for cash from the White Sox, lefty. Even though he profiles as a loogie, he was able to really do well against both sides in 2024. I think he's a sleeper. I wrote about him over at the Beyond the Mic. At the very least, he's probably going to get a spot as the second lefty there to Rayleigh for at least the first month of the season, assuming he has a decent enough performance here in the spring. And then that really leaves at that point. So you have Brazenbaum, who I know there's some debate about whether he has some options left. You have Tobias Myers, who has options left. You have the veteran Craig Kimbrell, who's coming here. And by the way, you know he's going to want to pitch because if he makes the club, I don't think he's making a couple of million bucks. Usually guys like that don't want to put the time and the effort in at this point in their career if they made a lot of money for a couple of million bucks. So you know that's somebody who definitely wants to pitch. I think Kimbrell, with a decent spring, will make the club. I think that Myers is going to be more looked at as rotation depth. I think Brazenbaum has a solid shot at making the club because he could be their bulk guy. He could be a guy that they worked at last year at going multiple innings. I mean, he has great stuff. The problem with Brazenbaum has been confidence, has been in high leverage situations. He tends to not be his best self. But if you want to bring a guy in that could give you some innings when the team is down, maybe in a blowout game when you're ahead, come in early when a starter's struggling, Brazenbaum's that guy. And he has options, so you can, if he gets a little overworked, option him down. So I think ultimately Hudson's going to get called up and he's going to make the club. for Minter, and then we'll see what happens when Minter comes back. I think Brazenbaum makes it as a bulk reliever, and then I think Kimbrel, unless he's completely bad in the spring, makes the club. When Nunez gets put on the 60-day IL, I think Kimbrel will slide in. I don't think he would have came here unless he had a real shot at making the club. I don't think this is a long-shot situation. I think Kimbrel was told, hey, you pitch like, and he pitched pretty well in Houston last year. You pitch like that, you're going to make the club at this point. The interesting thing, like I said, you have young arms. Here's a Christian Scott who was brought up to help the Mets rotation in 2024. A lot of people forgot about him, myself included. He was a part of that OMG summer until he got hurt later in the year. He's on the outside looking in, a great option to be brought up. Jonah Tong, who's making big starts down the stretch, on the outside looking in. You know, you have Pintaro and Hageman. I'm not sure where they fit in. You know, maybe the 27th man in bullpen shuttles. And then, you know, you've got Tobias Myers. Here's a guy that pitched in a decisive game three, pitched well against the Mets. He may be spending some time in Syracuse this year. The Mets are in a great position pitching-wise. Now, does that translate to health? Does that translate to success? We'll see. Even in the bullpen, you got to feel really good about this club. And I haven't even gotten into some of the scrap heap guys, and I'm not going to go deep into those guys. We've talked about this over at Extra Innings, over at the premium content. You know, Robert Stock, Brandon Waddell, guys like that. I know Duarte's name has come up. Anderson Severino. I mean, there's so many interesting names. All off season when we were doing our Trash or Treasure segments over at Extra Innings, there was an arm that came up that you just got to say, oh, this is an interesting arm and things like that. You know, you got Gerber on the roster, Carrillo. I don't know if any of these guys have legit shots. I think that options are going to play big into this. Now, I know there's a couple of names I left off, and I think they deserve a spot on the roster, but I think options in their contract make them a better bet to start the season in the minors. That's Adbert Alzolay, who I think is going to play a big part and could potentially be a high leverage reliever before the season's out, almost like a deadline acquisition. Coming off Tommy John surgery, Mets signed him to a 2-year minor league deal. Unless there's something in his deal that guarantees that he has to make the roster by a certain point, I think he starts the season to get his sea legs in AAA. Allows Hudson to make the roster. It allows them to see more Brazenbaum with options and potentially see what Craig Kimbrel, a veteran, has left. And then if those things turn out in the negative, Alzolay is the next man up. I think Austin Warren is a guy that, if he got a shot, could be a decent play out of the pen. Maybe he can be a better bulk reliever than Brazenbaum. Maybe he and Brazenbaum shuttle this season. You know, if they still have options. Now, the key is, does Brazenbaum still have options? I told you there's debate. Fangraff says yes, DeComo says no, and that's the way it is. So, look, you have your core four guys in the bullpen. They're going to make it. Hudson's there temporarily, and we'll see if he sticks around. There might be a bit of a, because he doesn't have option, might be a bit of a controversy there when Minter comes back. Then you have your Brazenbaum and Kimbrel making the club. You have your six starters assuming health. I don't see any scenario where the Peralta, McClain, Peterson, Holmes, Manaea, Senga are not the six starters coming north. And then I don't think Reed, Garrett, or McGill are options this year because of TJ, but they're on the 60-day IL. Who knows what later in the year that, you know, situation they have. Mets have a lot of great options. It's a really fun, interesting scenario here. And those are some of the players I'm looking for this spring. And of course, as we watch the games, a kid, you know, a Ryan Lambert. I know I even brought up Dylan Ross. I just, you know, could they push their way into the mix? Sure, they can. I just think that to start the season, and the way that Stearns has talked about fluid bullpens, you use the options you have available to you. If they have options, why not start them in the minors? Let's see what they got. See what Kimbrel's got. See what Brazenbaum's got. Luis Garcia, very minimal contract of a couple of million bucks. He flops. You could always release him. It'll be interesting how they play that. So that's where I see the pitching positional battles go. You know, that's where it's at right now. We'll see how this develops as the games start in about a week. All right, let's take a quick break. I want to give you my thoughts on the Jeff Passan article and upcoming labor strife. Both sides better be careful here because there's a lot of talk, harsh talk. And I think ultimately this is a situation where for the first time you, the fans, have a ton of power. And I think both sides better be careful here. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. All right, we're back. So Jeff Passan wrote a piece over at ESPN early this week talking about how the spending of the offseason, teams like the Mets, the Kyle Tucker situation with the Dodgers, I think was kind of the thing that broke the levees. But, you know, you're talking about two sides here as we head into a possible labor conversation. Two sides, the players associate and the owners, that really don't like each other. I think the divide is getting towards the level. I don't know if it's 1994 level. Remember, there was collusion in the 80s that was still raw with the players. It was a totally different early free agency years. I don't know if you could get to that point of how bad things were back then. I lived it. I remember it. But I think there's like three points here that really everybody needs to remember. One, baseball's not like the NFL or the NBA or the NHL, and I'll put hockey aside. But, you know, when you talk about parity, when you put together a really good team, I know the NBA has done a lot of things with their salary cap and made it really hard for teams to be stacked. I mean, there is a situation where I think it's actually pushed a lot of good veterans out of job because, quite honestly, there's no room for teams, especially good teams, to bring them on even as a 10th, 11th, 12th man because they'd be above a competitive balance apron, which would limit their transaction movement. I think it's actually harmed, in some ways, the players in that sense in the spirit of competition at that point or competitive balance. I mean, if you look at champions over the years, the NBA, up until maybe recently, and I know that you know, there's been a little bit more parity over the last few years. We'll see what Oklahoma City and what they've built, and they've built it the right way. They've built it organically, not through free agency, and they may have to be penalized for that because of the cap situation in the NBA. The NBA was not a very big parity league in the 90s. Between the Bulls, the Lakers dynasty, San Antonio. You want to punish them for that? You want to punish them for being successful? I don't think that that's the right thing. And the Dodgers, to me, maybe you could argue on the deferred salaries and how it's factored in and all that stuff. I mean, eventually those salaries have to be paid, and maybe the Guggenheim Group won't even own the team when those salaries have to be paid out. That'll be interesting. You know, maybe that's something to look at. But, I mean, when it comes to baseball, I am not walking into this season saying there's no hope. I mean, you look at the Dodgers, and if you look at what Vegas sees in terms of win total, yeah, the Dodgers are projected about 105 wins. Okay, good luck taking the over on that. No matter how good a team you are, it's not easy to win at that level. Injuries, travel, in baseball, it takes is a hot starting pitcher on any given day to stop a winning streak. I'm not so sure that they're a shoe in there, even at 105 wins. Now, look, going into a short series with all the resources, the tools, the weapons, they're going to be tough to beat. No doubt about it. But it's a short series. And this is the same team that was a hair away from being beaten by Toronto. You know, maybe Connor Falafa gets a better jump off third base. They're not even talking about the Dodgers as a champion at this point. So I'm not so sure competitive balance can't be achieved. Now, for teams to keep their own players, their superstars in smaller markets, for them to afford the cost of the rising very good player. Let's face it, a very good player is entitled to, based on the market, $20 to $25 million a year. And if your payroll's at $100, $125, $150, it's going to be very hard to have multiples of that. Very, very hard. Now, there's always the debate, you know, owners in markets where they don't have the same media revenue stream, the Ohio's, the Pittsburgh, Ohio teams, Pittsburgh, you know, go on, so on, so forth. Miami team, you know, down in Florida and what have you, they're not able to compete. Understand that. There needs to be something there. Is a salary cap the answer? No. I think that's just one piece of the pie. I mean, you have all this television money that Passan brings up, you know, the Amazon, the Netflix, the Paramount, ESPN, you know, all these different TV deals that have all these billions of dollars out there that you're going to lose if you don't play games, by the way. And look, you're going to have a small group of owners that are going to try to shut the sport down and burn it down to try to elicit a revolutionary change. And you're going to have players in the Players Association that want to sit back and say, look, you know, our prior generations fought for this freedom. We don't want to give it up. And both sides have merit to their conversation. I think the players have more merit than the owners. If you look at some, and again, nobody knows truly because the books aren't open. I think compared to, like, just say the NBA, where the players get about 49% to 51% of the revenues, I think baseball is about 5 or 6 points less in terms of the revenue sharing pie. You want to argue that it's millionaires and billionaires? I don't argue that. That's true. But the pie is the pie. And if you're a piece of the pie and your talent is creating the pie, you deserve a piece of it. Don't like the pie? Stop spending money. Don't get ESPN. Don't get Netflix. Don't go to games. Don't buy t-shirts. Don't listen to the Talking Mets podcast. Don't get involved. The pie shrinks. That's the way business is. When a business stops seeing customers, it shrinks. Now, I think that's the key. And I think that's where both sides need to say, okay, both of us want to fight this fight. Both of us want to burn the barn down. And both of us want to win. One side trying to beat the other side in this is going to destroy the sport. And I don't want to hear about 1994 and look how they came back and the home run race. You were in a much different sports world, the infancy of the sports world. And let me tell you, I lived it. When they went out on strike in 94, know what everybody around my parts in New York were talking about? The Knicks coming off of finals, the Rangers Stanley Cup, the football season. Nobody was worried about baseball coming back. Now, the hardcore baseball fans, when it came back, we came back. I came back. And yeah, you had your protest and the people who love to, you know, make a name for themselves by being counterculture. But yes, the Home Run Derby put it more into a national spotlight. And maybe from a New York perspective, because of the Yankees being here and winning a World Series and the emergence of the Bobby Valentine Mets, maybe we were in a different spot. But I don't think the sport was in dire straits. I think their lack of progress on media front, on the wild card and the play front played into that. And they addressed that. Bud Selig addressed that. So I think it's a different time. Here, I'm going to tell you something. You're already competing for a lot of people's attention. There's a lot of things at play, both sports and non-sports. Younger people are a different breed in terms of how they view sports, how they view teams, how they view loyalty. I don't think it's there. And if you believe that either side, shutting this thing down for a year, missing a season, being out of the minds and conscience of the fan, that the only interaction of baseball that they will have will be about labor, about law, about fighting over a large pie in an environment where there's the highest level of wealth envy that you've ever seen, where politicians promote wealth envy for their own devices. If you believe that that's good for business, if you believe that that's going to get this sport to where it needs to be, just over competitive balance, you will be cutting your nose to spite your face. They better realize it. Both sides better realize it. So if competitive balance is something that needs to be addressed, both sides are going to have to say, how do we address it? Look, do players want to play on losing teams? Do players, not want to be part of a league that, it's a fait accompli at the beginning of the year? I don't think you're there right now. I really don't. I mean, just look at the Dodgers went back-to-back World Series. It wasn't easy for them. Remember, they were a hair away from being eliminated by San Diego. If the Mets had done a couple of things here or there in this series against them, they would have beaten them in 24. Last year, we already talked about it. They were not a shoo-in to win that World Series. So, yeah. There's competitive advantages they have that make it much less likely that they're not going to make the playoffs. But I don't see where every other team is playing for second place here. This isn't the Harlem Globetrotters and the Washington Nationals. So, they really, and the big message I have there is if there are people ready to, or owners that are ready to burn the sport down to win labor negotiations, Rob Manfred better sit them in the room and teach them what the world is now. This is not 1994. Okay, and maybe they don't care about the sport and they want to get out of the business then. Sell the team. Yeah, maybe you're not making the same valuation on your team as the Mets or the Yankees or the Dodgers. Get out, take your generational wealth, go do something else. Because right now, the only people that can own baseball teams are equity groups or the top 100 wealthy people in the country. You can't be like it used to be. Bud Selig, used car salesman, gets a group together, buys a team. What Mark Cuban did with a lot of money, but not the level of money you need now with the Mavericks in the late night. You can't do that anymore. Who has $3 billion laying around? At least. And then you have to fund the team after that. And look, I know the fans don't like to hear it. It's not the most profitable venture when you start to look at the overhead of running a team. Off the bat, if you have the Mets, you're in the hole of $350 million. That's a lot of tickets. That's a lot of hats. That's a lot of jerseys and t-shirts to sell. to get people into the ballpark. Not to mention, and look, the people who work around the players, they're the ones who get the short stick, in terms of salary. But, you know, you have to pay for your employees, too. It's expensive. Now, I'm not saying they don't make money, but I don't think it's the level of money you think. Revenues do not equal profits. That's one of the biggest misnomers I've seen people. Well, the team's worth $3 billion. Well, your house is worth X. That doesn't mean you have that in cash. You could sell it and get it, but until you sell it, you don't have it, which means you can't put that new swimming pool in because you don't have the cash to pay for it. You can't pay for your swimming pool based on your home's valuation unless you take out equity in it. So, I mean, the baseball's faced with a public right now that is very uneducated about finances, tons of wealth envy, tons of options. There's not as many Mike Silvas of the world and those who are loyal to Talking Mets. And if I were them, I'd be careful about burning the barn down here. I'd be real careful. So, all right, let's take a quick break. When we come back, a little bit more about this. Lou Schiff, baseball and law. What's his thoughts? Lawyer, retired judge. Wrote about the law and the commissioners and lawyers in baseball in general. His thoughts on labor strife right after this. We're back, and yeah, we're talking baseball and pitchers and catchers, and the full squads are going to be reporting. But earlier this week, there was some ominous news from Jeff Passan over at ESPN about labor distrust, labor strife, and you know, you got to address it. And I thought, who better to join us but Lou Schiff? Lou is a retired county court judge, adjunct professor, and he has a book, Attorneys of the Baseball Hall of Fame, a collection of biographical essays. And he's here to join us. And Lou, who better to know about what could be coming up here in baseball with labor strife? But a former judge, attorney, and somebody who's a little bit familiar with people not getting along in a courtroom, huh?
Yes, I am. And
we're not going to stand for you like Aaron Judge. This is a Mets-centric show. Sorry, Lou.
No, I'm not asking anybody. I've never asked anybody to stand for me. People didn't want to stand. It was quite all right. I got it, yeah.
So
thanks for having me on, Mike. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So as you stand here, someone who has studied the history of the sport, and it's funny, leading into this segment, you and I were talking, you're like, it's almost like the Players Association and the owners and everything that's been going on in north of 100 years in the sport, everything remains the same. We're kind of having the same conversations that we saw in the 70s, in the 80s, 1994. And right. Although there's been about two decades of labor peace, I think we're at an end of that. So I'm curious, someone who's done a lot of research on the sport from a legal perspective, some of your thoughts.
Well, when you're talking about the 80s, we can go back to the 1880s, and we can go back to a time where the kind of problems that we're looking at today, were looking at back then. And we start off the discussion of baseball and unions with John Montgomery Ward, and who is in the Hall of Fame. He was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 1964. Many years after he passed away, he was the first to organize players into the players' union and fighting the owners. And they started their own league, and they were fighting the owners for the very reasons why players are still fighting owners, is that they believe they're not getting their fair share of the monies. And although they were fighting back in the 1880s for the elimination of the reserve clause, the ball players today are fighting for what they believe is to be fair compensation. Now, when we look at it as a lens, and then you and I go back a ways following baseball, you look at it from a lens of, say, the 1960s or 1970s, ball players from those eras look at what the ball players are making today and are just flabbergasted. But when we look at it from the lens of society today, the amount of money being paid to ball players is being paid because, A, the owners do have the money to pay them, and they've agreed to this type of compensation. So when we go back to John Montgomery Ward, he became an attorney because he was upset that the Providence Grays traded him to the New York Gothams. and he wanted to figure out a way to stop it. But he wasn't an attorney at the time. So when he gets traded to the Gothams, which later became known as the New York Giants, he goes to school at Columbia, gets a law degree, and starts the fight that way. And although they lost their battles in court, they won as far as being able to be a foundation of what was to come in 1920, in the 1920s with the federal baseball case. And then we move forward to Toulson, and then we move forward to Flood. And so it's been an erosion of strength from the owners.
Yep. I mean, when you think about the history of sport, you mentioned Curt Flood, and somebody like me who grew up, started watching baseball in the 80s, the really early years of free agency. I didn't realize it as a kid, between the growth of sports, the change in free agency in all sports, you were living through a historical times. You didn't think about it at that time. But the reserve clause, an onerous type of way of holding salaries and players' movement down. I mean, it's mind-boggling from a modern perspective that that had to actually go to court and be fought. Think about it. Like, it's common sense. Like, but for years, it was a thing at this point. And maybe one of the influential commissioners, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, former what, federal judge, or what, if I'm not correct, he presided over the sport during. Before the integration, all the growth of the sport saw. And you wonder now with Rob Manfred, this is a critical time, another lawyer, a critical time where he's going to be retiring soon, but setting up the sport for the next generation. So we're kind of at this point where you're going to see people who are very trained in the legal world making decisions that, probably stick with us for many, many years to come.
Well, sports is a business, whether it's baseball, football, whatever the sport is. And all businesses need good attorneys to help navigate their way through whatever they have to do. And so the players, rightfully so, are employed, and they want what they consider to be their fair share. The current players' union was originally headed by a judge by the name of Cannon, who was from Texas, and he was handpicked by the owners to be the head of the union. And the players quickly saw this isn't going to work, and that's
Right.
when they hired Marvin Miller. And many folks think, and Marvin Miller is finally in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Many folks who have read my book, and I can talk about it in a little bit, said, "You missed a lawyer." And I go, "Well, who did we miss?" And they go, "Marvin Miller." And Marvin Miller was not a lawyer. He wasn't an attorney. He had represented labor unions in Detroit in the auto industry, and he was hired to represent them. And again, slowly chipped away. So the question comes up, what's going to happen when this contract is over? What will baseball do?
Yep, it's interesting. Yeah, very fair point. Lou Schiff, author, co-author of a book, Attorneys in the Baseball Hall of Fame, a collection of biographical essays, and thought it was pertinent, especially with some of the labor strife coming up, to bring him on. What I think, from a standpoint, without getting too deep in the weeds, because it's so early in the game, I understand the need for competitive balance, although I think that there is more revenue to reinvest in teams than sometimes the fans think. It's a private business. They're not showing their books. Estimates have the Players Association getting about 44 to 47% of overall revenues. That's much lower. I think the NBA players get about 50 to 51. So there's two very big issues here, Lou. One, in a bigger piece of a pie, that they are the product. When people complain to me, well, they make too much money, don't go to the game, don't spend the money, shrink the pie. If the pie shrinks, our problem is solved. Nobody likes that answer when I give it to them. And then, of course, the owners, who are putting all the skin in the game, have all the money at stake. They got to get their piece. You, as someone who is an attorney, a judge, how do you see it? Like, is there a middle ground here? Because I think the problem in the past has been, if you have one side looking to burn it down and another side on the other corner saying, I'm not moving, we're not going to have baseball next year. And that is a disastrous situation.
Well, so here's something that I started to discuss with some of my friends. If the collective bargaining agreement expires, and there is a lockout, then we have no contracts.
Sure.
What is to stop the ball players from doing exactly what John Montgomery Ward did more than 100 years ago, close to 150 years ago, and say, we're going to form our own league?
Which the NBA players talked about. If you remember during the strike in 1999, they talked about that. That is fair. That creates a great level of organization. I'm sure there'd be plenty of business investment. And then obviously that would turn the sport upside down in terms of, you know, kind of like the ABA. So you're talking about like, let's form the baseball version of the ABA.
Okay, let's form a new league. And where are we going to play? Are we going to have 30 teams? Probably not. But could they put some teams in Canada? Sure they could. Could they go down and form a few teams in Mexico? Absolutely they could. So where are they going to play? Well, you're going to need stadiums.
Right.
Some of the ball clubs play in public-owned stadiums. But if there's a breach of a contract between the clubs and the city or the state where they play, who's to say that that city or state can't turn around and say, look, you breached your contract with us. You promised to have ball games there. You don't have it there anymore. You locked these players out. We're going to go get another tenant.
Right.
Now, that's other places, they're, you know, maybe they'll put a team in Buffalo. Maybe they'll put a team in Jersey instead of maybe they'll play to less people. Look how successful banana ball has been.
Right.
So why can't ball players just say, we've had enough of you and we're going to start our own league? Now, that comes with a lot of problems because the money's not there right away. And so the ball players may think that they're worth what they're worth, but the money may not be there.
The pie's not there. When the pie's not there, it doesn't matter what you're worth.
And that's what was that led to the collapse of what John Montgomery Ward did. They for a while, player salaries went up. Right. There's some famous cases going back into the 1880s where ball players wanted the reserve clause to end. And judges basically said, look, this is only a 6 month a year occupation. If you want to make more money, go back to the farms where you are. You can make more money doing what you did outside of the game. And, and so who's going to blink first? That's where we are. Who's going to blink first? And the fans are not going to. You know, this is can this be 1994 all over again, where where there's no World Series, there's no games, and it's going to take 3 decades for people to finally come back and watch the game again?
Right, that's a good point. So, Lou, your book "Baseball and Law," you know, talks about the group of you know, basically there have been players that have been lawyers, two managers, Tony La Russa being one of them. Executives that were lawyers, Branch Rickey, everybody here in the New York area knows Branch Rickey, obviously. I thought, well, if you really look, when you look at the commissioners, I thought there was five. If you look at Faye Vincent, there's three. So I have Kennesaw Mountain Landis, Happy Chandler, Bowie Kuhn, Faye Vincent, and Rob Manfred, as I had down with lawyers. But
well, Faye Vincent is not in the Hall of Fame.
Right. You're talking about those in the Hall of Fame for sure. You know what? He probably is an underrated commissioner too, Faye Vincent, because of the time that he got pushed out, and it was a tough time. So you also have commissioners that were not lawyers. I'm curious, as you were going through your research, did you see a difference in leadership style between the two types of commissioners, those that have a legal background and those that are maybe coming more from a journalistic background, business background? And obviously, Bud Selig being a former team owner, a used car salesman was his background. That's the truth. People don't realize that. You know, the different styles, I would wonder.
I don't know if you, there's no prerequisite to being an attorney to be a commission. You take Bowie Kuhn, when he got out of law school, University of Virginia, he went to work at the law firm that represented the National League. And it was his goal as a young man, he wanted to become a baseball commissioner. That's what he strived for. So he aligned himself up. He was a smart enough individual. He aligned himself up with the leagues so he could proceed and try to get there one day. Happy Chandler, who also is in the Hall of Fame. He was kind of like the right place at the right time. He was a consensus candidate after somebody else didn't make it. He was the former governor of Kentucky, former senator, and he was just at that time like a right person to be there. And so, to answer the question, I don't think you have to be an attorney to be the baseball commissioner. You have to surround yourself with individuals who understand business and law in order to do it. But if you look at, say, Major League Baseball and the Major League Baseball Players Association today, they both have dozens of in-house counsel, plus the attorneys they hire on the outside as
Sure,
well.
sure, sure. Absolutely. Every time someone does a project like this and I ask them about their process, did you learn something about an individual that you were surprised about or something that you didn't expect? Like, what's kind of like that aha, learning as you wrote this book?
Great question. So Mike, originally Bob Jarvis and I wrote a law school textbook that's still used in law schools today called Baseball and the Law Cases and Material, and that was published by Carolina Academic Press in 2016, and we received the Sabre Research Award for it in 2017. And there we trace the history of baseball through law cases. It started out as like a 500-page project, and when we got it done, it was over 1,000 pages. When we got done with that project, I said to him, "I have another project I want to do, but I don't want to make it an academic. I want to make it a reading project." And so I said, and I had already started doing the research. There were 11 attorneys in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and Bob was busy with another project, and I was busy being a full-time judge. And so he said, "Write the book yourself." And I said, "I can't write the book myself. I need someone to help me." So we put it on hold. And a couple of years ago, he contacted me, and we talked over the years. We're friends. And he goes, "You want to do that baseball book about the attorneys?" And I said, "Sure." So we found a publisher, McFarland, who loved the idea. And then through some of Bob's contacts and my contacts, mostly Bob's in the professor area, we found 10 of us, including Bob and myself, to write chapters in the book, with Bob and I co-writing the first chapter and then everybody else taking an individual chapter. And we put it together that way. Bob came up with a rubric for the book so it reads in one voice. And I'm real proud of it because in the 11 chapters, we have over 1,300 footnotes. And that's where we do some really deep digging into the men that are in the Hall of Fame. So if we give you a fact, you can go to the newspaper clipping we found it, you can read the law case that we found it, and you can dig as deep as you want to, or just ignore the notes entirely. So to answer your questions, what did I learn? Well, if we start out with the two people I researched, we've got Kennesaw Mountain Landis. Some people would call him a racist. Okay.
That's been talked
Okay.
about a lot.
Misogynist. Okay. And the more we researched him, the more it became apparent that although the quote, "He was the man that saved baseball," I wouldn't put him on the Mount Rushmore of attorneys that are in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Much different style, very heavy-handed style, different time where an authoritarian type of commissioner worked. You can't, well, now you have an owner commissioner. You can't, I don't think what Kennesaw Mountain Landis, could you use some of that to get these two guys together? Sure. It'll never happen because the owners won't allow it to happen at this point.
Well, and that's some of the issues. But some of the things I learned about Kennesaw Mountain Landis was that he was not necessarily a good man. In fact, there came a time when he first became commissioner that he was holding two jobs, that of a federal judge who was appointed by Teddy Roosevelt, and that of the baseball commissioner. And he refused to yield. He refused to give up his federal judgeship. And Congress started impeachment proceedings against him. Now, what came out of this whole thing is he eventually resigned. And as a result of his actions, the American Bar Association came up with the Canons of Judicial Conduct. Prior to that, there were no canons for judges on things that you should or shouldn't do. And so when I talked to judges or lawyers or even the general public, and I asked, "Does anybody know why we have judicial canons of ethics?" The one word answer is baseball. That's the American Bar Association censored him. The press turned against him at the time, that he couldn't do both jobs, and he finally stepped aside. He took the job that paid him more, and he stayed with that job up until his death in like I think 1944 or so.
You know, the one other law component that always comes up and has been talked about years is the antitrust exemption that baseball has. Historic, like nobody else has that. I would believe labor strife, especially if it gets national news, especially if we're talking about a long-term lockout, possibly losing the season. I mean, I believe, I don't think it's just rhetoric. I think there's a handful of owners that are okay with losing the season next year to elicit change. You have to think that that would come up. And really, when you think about it, it's crazy to think that baseball has an antitrust exemption. No other business. Imagine if other businesses, well, they did back in the day, but imagine if businesses had that, what they could do, what they could charge. And I understand that there's some credence to it, but I'm curious. I think that becomes a big story if this thing gets ugly next year.
Well, if baseball has this exemption, but over the years it's been kind of bargained away. The players have gained some things. The owners have conceded many things. And so the exemption, the way it was first written in the 1922 case, isn't the same as it is today. Again, because of collective bargaining and the Curt Flood Act and things of that nature. So it's a lot different because in 1922, the Supreme Court wrote that the business of baseball was just playing the games, and they didn't consider traveling from state to state part of interstate commerce the way we would consider it today. You
Today.
compare that to the Roselle case in the NFL versus Pete Roselle, where the NFL was arguing to, again, be like baseball. The Supreme Court said, no, you're not like baseball. And in fact, if we had to reconsider baseball, we might. And so every once in a while, Congress has these hearings where they start rattling baseball's cage and saying, we're going to take away your exemption. And Congress can do that. When you read what the Supreme Court has written, the Supreme Court, it's kind of like the Wizard of Oz with Darth.
Yeah,
You've all
yes,
the power. Congress,
right.
you have the power. If you want to take away the exemption and you don't like our decision, well, then legislate it away and take away the exemption. They can do that.
I could see that being much more real in this modern political era than ever before. I don't know the same connection to baseball. There's a different collection of politicians up and down that chamber. So it'd be something interesting. Maybe this is, as we wrap up here, before you give us where we could get the book, do you, as Rob Manfred moves out and he's talked about retiring in the next couple of years, do you see any young legal minds or older legal minds or somebody that could be his replacement? Because the next commissioner is taking this sport in a new world that's shrinking because of the internet, because of AI, because of, I mean, there's so many things that baseball has, oh, which has always been behind in a lot of ways, can learn from other sports, but without, and they're a tricky spot because you have the fans like me that we don't mind change and progress, but don't mess with the fundamental constitution of the sport. Like you have that fundamental constitution. So I think that might be a challenge. Is there a name of maybe somebody in the legal profession that you feel could be the next, Rob Manfred or the next big, name to usher this sport into a new era?
I don't know about big names, but I'll do it.
You.
I mean, I don't laugh. I have the background
There
for
you
it. I have
go.
the
Put your
legal
hat in the
degree. I
ring.
have the legal degree. I've written some books on this.
There you
Some
go.
call me a
There you go.
historian and a baseball scholar. I could do it. People might say, "Well, you're 70 years old. You're too old to do it." But I'm healthy. I can be a
You
caretaker
don't come,
for a few years.
you don't have the energy level of a typical 70-year-old. I could tell just talking to
I can do this. If you give me the ball and put me in, coach, I can still throw strikes. It may
There you
not
go.
it may be Ephus pitches, but I can still throw a strike.
You can
I
still
don't know
do it.
who's going to do it because it always seems to be sometimes there's a surprise candidate that comes out.
Sure.
And so these are some of the issues that come about. I don't know the backgrounds of the assistants to the commissioner or who's going to be there. Is it going to be somebody from another ball club? Is it going to be a deal that's cut with somebody to do something?
Right.
I don't know. But remember that the baseball commissioner is hired by the owners. And the baseball commissioner, if and you look at like a guy like William Eckert, he came in, he was a general. They hired him because he had been a general, and he quickly fell out of the favor of the owners, and they moved on. And so if you don't have the support of the owners, your tenure as a commissioner is going to be short-lived.
Very short-lived. So, Lou, where can the listeners, whether they're a law student interested in being a law student, or just interested in the history of baseball, where can they get that their book and tell us what's next? If there's anything
So
more, is there another project on the way?
they can get the book, they can get it on Amazon. Attorneys in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Here's a copy of it. They can get
There
this
you go.
on Amazon. There you go. They can get that on Amazon. And Amazon has it as a as the soft covered book, as well as a Kindle edition. Amazon has been discounting the book. It's a $45 list. I think this morning it was about $36, and that included free shipping. If you're a Kindle person, it's $27.99. McFarland has a sale now. With the code SAVE, SAVE 26. And I think it's a 20% off of the book. They do charge shipping. So, and I know that Barnes and Noble has it as well. It's wherever you can find books online through
It's
distributors,
there.
that's
It's there.
where it's at. We've been very fortunate. The book early on was listed number one under sports law. It's been in the top 10 when the book came out the end of July. It's been listed in the top 10 most of that time. It's gotten some really nice reviews. American Bar Association, as well as others, have given it thumbs up, and we're very, very grateful for it. We have a really good group of law professors and law librarians who contributed to this project.
Well, Lou, it's been a pleasure. This is a
Same here,
topic
Mike.
that nobody w really wants to address, but I think it's going to be a big story as we get later in the year. And look, if there is no baseball and we need a legal conversation, you're our guy. So you've
Thank
just
you.
been anointed the Talking Mets judge slash lawyer slash contributor. You know, we don't pay like the big cable networks, but you know, we could have some fun while we're at it.
It's
So,
all good.
all right. Thank you, Lou. Thank you for joining us on this weekend morning. All righty.
Thank you, Michael.
That's Lou Schiff. Lou Schiff is the author of Baseball and Law. Let's take a quick break. When we come back, mailbag, a special mailbag with a special contributor. You're listening to the Talking Mets podcast. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back, and we have our mailbag, and I'm trying something different today. So usually you hear from me, and I go through the comments from all the listeners, but I decided, why don't I bring some help from a friend? And this is an account. If you're not following him on X, I've been thoroughly enjoying his work throughout the offseason. It's John from Mets Metrics at underscore Mets Metrics. If you're listening, stop, go to X, follow him. He's going to be helping me with the mailbag because he's into advanced analytics. I am too, but I come from a different generation. John's a little younger than me, and he's joining us. John, welcome to the program. And why don't you let the listeners know a little bit about what you do there over at Mets Metrics if they're hearing from you from the first time?
Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me. So basically, I just break down anything going on with current Mets news, just give you your daily updates. But I try to look at it from the same perspective that the Mets are looking at it. And I also tend to agree with that perspective. And it's just David Stearns and the Mets, they're widely respected around baseball. So I try to trust what they're doing and look at it from their point of view. So if you want to understand more about what's going on with the team, why certain players aren't there, certain players are there, or certain roster moves are being made, I think you should check out my account.
Absolutely. At underscore Mets Metrics, and we'll get kicked off. So, John, the first topic of conversation by the listeners, and I think it's something that you've seen over on X and other social media Mets-centric sites, is Jorge Polanco playing first base. And I think sometimes here we take the whole run prevention conversation that Stearns has, and we put it as gospel. Me, my old school baseball mind, where I am more focused on defenses up the middle. I think it's important. You have to have competency at the corners in both left and right. Maybe more defensive acumen in right. The corners of first and third. I look at competency. So, Look, Jorge Polanco is not the first guy to transition to first base. You list actually some over at Mets Metrics. Now, I'll give the listeners a more dated type of transition. Rod Carew was a second baseman, all-star second baseman. At about the age of 30, he moved to first base. Now, there wasn't advanced metrics back then, but from all the resources that were out there, you could go back to old Baseball Digest, Sporting News. Yes, I'm dating myself. He was steady and dependable and was good enough where that's where he spent the rest of his Hall of Fame career. So I know there's some videos out there of Polanco that seem that he has some athleticism that was missing with Alonso. Thoughts on, I mean, do you agree with me? I'm not worried about Polanco first base as long as he's serviceable and can get the job done and support the what I think Pete Alonso did pretty well was support some of the wonky throws that come from the left side of the infield.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. You need to have good defense up the middle. It can't like that's just the most important thing. So when David Stearns emphasized run prevention, it, and he added guys like Luis Robert and Marcus Semien, and those are guys up the middle who really help. Jorge Polanco, he was a career shortstop, second baseman, third baseman, even, and he's a very athletic player. And he might not be the best defensive first baseman in the league, but that doesn't mean that it doesn't help the run prevention. He still should be better than Pete. And even if he's not better than Pete defensively, he makes half the money. You're not investing a ton of money at a position that isn't as valued as a lot of other positions around the league.
Well, you list over at Mets Metrics early January. You mentioned Jonathan Aranda, Michael Busch, Vlad Guerrero, who used to be a third baseman, Vlad Guerrero Jr., Colt Keith, as examples of those that actually, I guess, got better at first base. Am I correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's not about being better. Like, yes, they got better, but they weren't necessarily great. They were serviceable first basemen, but that's really all you need there. And I think there's no reason why Polanco can't be that.
Now, the other thing that's been talked about in the chat room here over at Talkin' Mets and emails and whatnot is Bo Bichette. So Bo Bichette's a shortstop, was not a great, did not grade out well from a range perspective at short. Toronto puts him at second in the World Series. I personally thought throughout the offseason that's where he'd probably wind up somewhere. I believe the Phillies actually were signing him to play third base like the Mets, if I'm not mistaken. They have Trey Turner at short. So, you also at Mets Metrics talk about Bo Bichette. Again, if you're a okay shortstop, and Carlos Correa was a much better shortstop defensively than Bo Bichette, and he was going to make the move to third when the Mets signed him briefly before the failed physical. I'm actually not that concerned about Bo Bichette at third base. Now, let's also remember, Mark Vientos, who has a great arm, played third base a lot in 2024. Yes, they had Iglesias back him up late for defense, but you could also spot which pitcher on the mound would mitigate third base defense as well. Not everybody's going to get the same volume at third base, but I'm actually not concerned about Bichette at third base, really. And if it becomes a defensive issue, you could always slide Beatty in there for defense late. I don't think it'll come to that, especially with Bichette's bat. So, do you agree? And I think you ran some metrics as to, maybe why this is not a big deal.
I mean, it really is not a big deal at all. He was a shortstop moving to third base. At shortstop, you need a lot more range than you need at third base, and that's really where he struggled. He did not have range at short, but that should be masked at third. And we've definitely seen it before where shortstops move to third base, and I mean, almost always it's just a seamless transition. I'm really not concerned at all about Bichette at third, and there's going to be some growing pains, but there's no reason why you shouldn't do it.
And the arm strength should not be a concern. I know that his arm wasn't great at maybe at short all the time. You actually put up earlier in the week, about a week ago, less than that, some comparisons of Bichette's arm strength
Yeah.
from Baseball Savant. Why don't you chat about that? Because that was interesting.
So on Baseball Savant, the average arm strength for a shortstop and a third baseman are essentially the same. Shortstop actually has a stronger average arm strength than the third base position. So a lot of people paint third base to be some position that you need a gun, but it's not necessarily true. We see plenty of guys like Bregman and other third basemen who do not have good arms, and they're perfectly fine there. He actually has a better arm than Beatty, who was playing third last season. So it's just not going to be an issue. He has the range to make up for it because a shortstop moving to third baseman, like they should have better range. They should be able to have better range than a lot of third basemen there. And that's really the main factor. Like the arm strength is there. It's not horrible. And he's going to be able to get the throws across. And as long as he has the reactions to make the plays, there's going to be no issues.
So one of the other things I talked about earlier, and I think it may be moot point depending on Lindor's return. Let's assume Lindor is going to miss the first 10 to 15 days of the season, give him an extra week of extended spring to get back, get his swing going. Not the end of the world. There's talk about the shortstop position. Now, in my this was my opinion, and the fans have brought up the question, where would you go? I say, okay, if Mauricio has a good spring. He was elite. I mean, I don't think people realize how elite he was with outs above average. And even just watching him, he was an elite third baseman. Great hands. He showed a lot of third base, gold glove instincts, very quietly. You could see the metrics over at Savant. They'll show you that. I'm assuming he could play an adequate enough short, and that's where he has started his baseball career. And if he could play every day, and then obviously he'd have to be sent back to the minors with his options when Lindor comes back, I'm fine with him getting the everyday job. I don't see a scenario where some of the fans have said, do you temporarily move Simeon to short, put Beatty at second? There's also the option of some of these non-roster invitees like Kessinger or Brujan maybe temporarily manning the position. I do not see a scenario where Polanco stays there temporarily. Once he's playing first, you want him to stay at first. He wasn't a great shortstop when he was there. And then, of course, we just talked about Bo Bichette. I don't think you want to keep Bo Bichette there for 2 weeks. You want him getting his reps at third, although maybe you could argue if Mauricio isn't the guy, offensively it's a better lineup with Beatty at third and Bichette at short instead of one of the non-roster guys or utility guys like a Brujan. So where are you at with shortstop? Do you agree with that? Do you have some ideas? And talk, what have you seen? Have you looked at any of the metrics with Mauricio defensively? And he might be a very, very good shortstop if it plays out.
Yeah, so I thought about this a lot, and Mauricio would definitely be my preference at shortstop if this were to happen. The only issue with Mauricio is he only has one option left. So let's say they bring him up and he's only up for a week, 2 weeks. It's the first 2 weeks of the season and you're already using his option. So that's not really ideal. I don't know if they want to do that. I honestly I would assume they don't want to do that. So I really do think it's likely that Simeon plays shortstop, and I think we see Beatty at second base while well in the case that Lindor has to go on the IL. But
Interesting.
I
Interesting. He hasn't played short in a long time, but that's interesting.
yes, it has been a little while, and he definitely has had his ups and downs at shortstop, which is basically why he's a second baseman now. But I think for a short period of time, I can definitely see it. If this were to be like a long-term injury to Lindor, I think Bichette probably would have just been shortstop, but that doesn't seem like it's going to be the case.
Out of some of the young kids, whether it be a bullpen arm, whether it be the standard kids, the Alvarez, the Beatty, Carson Benj's name is brought up. Give me one obvious, player you're watching this spring. Give me an under the radar player you're watching this spring. Could be any position.
All right, well, of course we were watching Carson Benj this spring. Every Met fan wants this guy to make the roster. I think everyone can agree on that. We're all rooting for this kid to make the roster out of spring, be the everyday outfielder. So watching him in spring is going to be really exciting. But an under the radar guy I'm looking forward to this spring is Luis Garcia, because Luis Garcia out of the bullpen could be exactly what this team needs. And I think having a guy who's a right-handed pitcher who can throw hard like Garcia can is a good fit with the other right-handed pitchers being Luke Weaver and Devin Williams. So if Garcia can be productive, that'll be good for the bullpen this season. It'll be a really big deal.
Interesting you bring up Garcia because when you look at Garcia's numbers, veteran, Mets got him for a very reasonable contract. He's one of the locks I talked about in the open, in the bullpen. His numbers aren't sexy, to be honest, but he grades out well in stuff. He's a guy that, when he's on, throws strikes. In a lot of ways, maybe the Mets work with him on some things. He's one of those guys that you could put in there. I'm assuming because of his age, they're not going to worry about usage. They're going to make him like a rubber arm. I look at him as a sixth or seventh inning guy, a guy that could bridge a short starter outing, maybe get some outs when there's not a need for high leverage, maybe a 3-4 run game where you feel confident you don't need to use your big guys. To me, listening, just looking at the stuff plus metrics on Fangraphs, listening to you, Garcia's back of the baseball card doesn't match up to maybe what he can be.
No, I mean, he's definitely projected to be better than he's been at times. I mean, last season was an awful year for him. He had a 3.42 ERA last season, but prior seasons he did have some ups and downs. He was also played on many teams last year, but the Oopsie projection for 2026 has him at a 3.68 ERA over 59 innings, and if we can get production similar to that would be nice for this bullpen, especially since he brings velocity out of the bullpen.
Having a lot of fun here during the mailbag, taking topics that you guys put on the chat room, the mailbag, and our friend John from Mets Metrics is helping me out, giving a different perspective. Wanted to hear from you, something new we're trying here over at the podcast. I'll give you a name that I'm looking for on the bullpen side that I think might be better. He has options. He was up here last year. Austin Warren is one name that I'm looking at. Not sure if you looked at Austin Warren, but he's actually not really gotten a shot, but when he's pitched well throughout his career.
Yeah, I've always kind of thought, like, hey, why isn't this guy getting more time at the major leagues? He doesn't seem, especially last season with the product that they put out on the field, he didn't seem like he would be worse than a lot of the pitchers they had. And he has performed fairly well in the small sample. So I mean, obviously, there's other things and why the team doesn't like him, but he's productive, and if he can come in as depth and eat some innings out of the bullpen, that's great.
Mets didn't wind up signing Nick Castellanos. I think that was something that made a lot of fans happy. I wasn't really into. I mean, he's forget about all the clubhouse things in Philadelphia. He was in decline. Right now, if Carson Bench doesn't produce, doesn't make the team, let's say he needs more seasoning. He doesn't have. I think he has a great shot of making the team, even with just an okay spring training. It sounds like they want to really give him a shot, but the Mets don't necessarily have that veteran that could slide in. Soto's going to left. We'll get to that in a minute. I think that's a great move. I think that's a move that should have been made years ago. San Diego actually made that move. And where do you see that? I mean, the Mets passed up on Castellanos. I'm okay with that. Where do you see if Benj doesn't make the roster? It's at maybe an MJ Melendez. I know Jared Young is on the team. He's more of a corner guy. I don't really think he's an outfielder. Nick Morabito, I don't think he's a starter. It'd be interesting how they go, or is there a veteran outfielder that emerges in the spring? I know Conforto still doesn't have a home and what have you, that maybe they look to if Benj is looking bad around, let's say March 15th.
So I think Brett Beatty will get an opportunity of some type outfield. We'll know
Which is
more about that spring
crazy. I could
training.
never have imagined that. After watching clunk ground balls a couple of years ago and how much progress he's made at third, it's amazing that he's going to be potentially a right fielder.
And he really put it all together. But I just love the fact that we have a guy like Beatty moving into that Jeff McNeil role. But I really think that MJ Melendez is going to be a good piece off the bench.
The power, now he can play center field. One of the things I wonder though is, and I said this in the opening, will the Mets with Lindor's, and I know even if the habit is not a long-standing thing, does Lindor need a little bit more time? Maybe like once every couple of weeks, a day off. They've never really had a middle infield backup shortstop. They never really have had it. It's been more of those emergency options. It makes you wonder, does that put Melendez in a bad spot where you would take or keep a utility guy like Brujan even after, let's say, a Lindor comes back?
I don't think so. Only because I am a fan of MJ Melendez. They signed him to a major league contract for a reason. Like I think like this guy's gonna really provide some value off the bench. He's only 27 years old still. He has positive splits facing right-hand pitching, and he has nice power. He has real good power, something the Mets could definitely use. And he's a left-handed power bat, basically off the bench. Every team has one. His projected WRC plus from Oopsie is at a 92 for next season, which isn't far below field league average. He's a competent hitter, and he definitely shows signs of things to like for sure. Mostly
Absolutely.
power, but definitely things to like there.
Some of the names Sam wrote in to me, some of the names that he likes under the radar in the bullpen are Alzolay, who I like, Adbert Alzolay, who I think is eventually going to contribute this year, Mike Baughman, former top pick, Duarte, who we've heard a lot about, Joe Jaquez, the Pedro Feliciano clone, lefty side armor, and Nate Lavender. Any thoughts on any of those guys? Because to me, I said in the open, look, Alzolay is a guy I'm looking for, but any of these other, under the radar value, I call them trash or treasure signings. Like, let me see some progress. Let me see some performance. And let's not forget, there's also a 40-man roster crunch. Let's see something before we even put them in as an option at any point in time.
Yeah, I agree with you about Alzolay. I'm very excited for him. I can see him definitely being a high leverage arm in the bullpen if things pan out for him. Obviously, he's dealt with a lot of health issues, so the most important thing for him is that he's healthy and back to what he was with the Cubs. His last full season was really an elite season. Like, people are forgetting just how good this guy was that last season he was healthy. And if they can get production anywhere near that's just huge. That like this bullpen would be completely set if they can get Alzolay in the eighth, Minter in the eighth, and then hand it over to Devin Williams. That would be awesome, along with Luke Weaver too. I really do think Alzolay at his peak could be better than Luke Weaver.
I don't disagree with that. He's one of those guys that was a starter in Chicago. He wound up being converted, got hurt, obviously, to a closer. I agree with that. I think he starts the year, and I think that part of the play is he's got a minor league contract, so the Mets are going to try to use their options in minor league contracts. And I think a guy like Kimbrel, if he has a decent season, will get a shot. There's some debate whether Brazenbaum has options. Fangraph says he has it. I think Anthony DeComo says he doesn't. So that's something interesting. I guess we'll find out more about that. Jason brought up, had took umbrance with a point that I had made. Now I had said I thought Clay Holmes a couple of weeks ago could potentially be a number two starter. Now that he has a year under his belt, he has some of the best stuff plus on the staff. Some of them have compared him to Webb out of Chicago with the heavy sinker. Excuse me, out of San Francisco with the heavy sinker. He matches up well with Freddy Peralta and stuff, if you just believe in that over Fangraphs. Now, look, maybe he lands as a number three. Some last year, and he did pitch at times like a back end guy. He threw too many pitches, only went 5 innings. But I'm actually thinking that this could be, and he's going to have an opt out option. So, there's that motivation there to maybe get himself into a possible big long-term starter level contract, bigger money than what he's been seen as a reliever. I think Holmes could potentially be a veteran that takes a jump and does like a Sean Manaea type of jump. Do you agree with that? Because some don't like the underlying metrics with the amount of base runners, the expected ERA, and so forth.
I do agree with that. I think Holmes, like you said, his second season is going to play a bigger factor than most people and other guys who made the transition. But the thing about Clay Holmes is he's a ground ball hitter, pitcher. I'm sorry. They need good defense around them, and the Mets did a great job improving on the run prevention. And it's just going to benefit the entire staff, but especially Clay Holmes. Clay Holmes is a guy who he controls, but when the ball gets put in play, So I'm
Yep,
cutting
you're
out here.
there. I hear you, John. You're back. Yeah, that. So, yeah,
Sorry.
I definitely. That's okay. I definitely agree with you on that. The another comment here. You know, Griffin Canning signed with San Diego. Probably would have got a better shot coming back from the ACL injury. I thought the Mets, and I don't know if this is still a possibility. Yeah, a couple of quick things
Oh,
before
great.
we wrap up here, John. Griffin Canning signed with San Diego. And a couple of things before we wrap up. Griffin Canning signed with San Diego. I thought he was an underrated piece to the rotation last year. The Mets did great work with their pitching lab. Probably gets a better opportunity to pitch in the Mets rotation, in the San Diego rotation than the Mets rotation. Thought that Mets should look at some veterans that don't have a qualifying offer, maybe to bring in on a minor league deal as some veteran starting depth. Canning would have been something interesting as a potential midseason arm. What are your thoughts on that? And you know, I also think that on to you know, the one last thing as we wrap up, Christian Scott, Jonah Tong, you know, depending on how this six-man rotation plays, knowing there'll be some innings limitations on them, I could see them potentially doing what Stearns has done in the past with Peralta and Woodruff and being bullpen pieces later in the season.
Well, I completely agree with that last part. I thought Brandon Sproat was actually going to be a big part of the bullpen this year, but obviously he got traded. But yeah, so I don't think any arm will get signed. I think once they made the trade for Freddie Peralta and acquired Tobias Myers in that trade, I think that kind of put an end to any other pitcher that they had interest in. I thought Canning would have had. Like before that trade, I thought Canning definitely would have been a guy they brought back. But Tobias Myers is really going to take over that role. And like you said, Christian Scott, Jonah Tong, and then some other guys like Santucci and Weininger, who knows what they can be late, real late in the year. I think they're completely set on starting pitching, especially from for depth. I think any additions may be higher end additions, but I don't expect that for a long time, like all-star break, if that ever were to happen.
I see Myers getting stretched out in the minors and being used as a starter. I don't know if they would. I know they want a bulk reliever out of the pen. And if Hudson and Kimbrel come north in that scenario, assuming a six-man rotation, that doesn't leave room for Myers. Again, Myers has options. With six-man rotation, maybe there's a way they get creative and one of those six guys gets put in the bullpen, misses a start. I see them going with six just because of Senga, because they want to limit McClain's innings. I don't know how that's going to play with Peralta and Holmes veterans, Manaea. You know, maybe there's some kind of hybrid where they piece it together. So I think that'll be interesting. But I don't know if Myers is going to be a bullpen bulk guy. I think his future is a starter, controllable starter, and that's spending some time with the organization, honing his craft in the minors. What are your thoughts as we wrap up here on that?
I agree with you. I think he'll definitely be used as a starter early in the year and being stretched out. And it also seems like every single season, the ace on the Mets staff never pitches opening day. He's always on the injured list. So somebody's going to get hurt. Myers is going to take that spot. And he's one of the better depth pieces we've had in a long time who can really be a legit part of the rotation or bullpen. Now, later in the season, I think he will go into a bullpen role, and that's going to be very valuable down the stretch, eating innings, multiple innings at a time, and really helping out the starting staff.
So, John, as we wrap up here, Mets Metrics at underscore Mets Metrics. What are you going to be looking at the next couple of weeks? Those who want to follow you on X, tell us a little bit about what's on your mind. What are some of the things that you're trying to put out there, look at, assess, what have you?
Mostly just pitching and bullpen arms. Last season, we saw a lot of exciting bullpen arms in spring training. And because people forget early in the year, Brazoban, Kranick, they were very important early in the season. So I want to look for guys who I think could be potential breakouts in the bullpen and bench pieces. I'm excited for these options that they have between Arroyo, Melendez, and Vidal Brujan. So I really like the
Interesting.
depth on this team.
Well, listen, John, new segment. Appreciate you contributing, getting us some information, helping us with the mailbag. We'll be in touch. We'll be following you at underscore Mets Metrics. If you're not following, follow them now. John, be well. Thanks again for coming on.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate you, Mike.
John from Mets Metrics, good stuff. I like how he's adding some components followed by some big Mets accounts too. So that's it. Big show. We talked about positional battles set up the spring. The full squad should be reporting with the tomorrow, I believe the 16th. We're a week away, less than a week away from spring games. The journey has begun. So we put the hot stove behind us. It's starting to warm up here in New York. So hopefully now we feel like it's baseball. We are talking about baseball, not about transactions. And I know we threw a little bit of labor strife in the mix, and that is a big story and it's something to watch. But we'll put that in the closet now that we kind of kicked it off here on the Talking Mets podcast. All right, that's it. You can check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And you can get me on the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get updates to the show, interact with me, chat for free, premium content, all at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. I'm your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back with another Talking Mets podcast next week. Till then, take care, everybody.